This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our Doctor in the House series. I'm Meera Sivasothi and co-hosting with me, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist. It's a Friday, George. How are you today?
Meera, truthfully, I'm missing you badly.
Besides that, I don't know when I'm going to see you, George, at the rate we're going.
At this rate, probably 2025.
You know, we can only laugh about it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just laugh it off because there's just so much doom and gloom. And there's this cloud hanging over us. And, you know, we need to laugh a little bit more, right, George?
Well, Meera, last time we spoke, you know, it was 2 weeks ago. And we have some degree of optimism about perhaps, you know, seeing how different countries open up to their nations and, you know, all these light at the end of the tunnel. But it seems like a lifetime away. You know, this lifetime ago when 2 weeks ago our numbers were still manageable. And now it seems like a little bit out of control. We can always pray for everyone's safety out there.
Yes. I mean, stay safe. But you know what? On the plus side, with vaccinated just over 12% of our population, we've done extremely well, George. We're doing one of the best in the world in terms of vaccination rate. So we're very proud of that. Forget the numbers. Just look after yourself. The Delta variant is making its rounds. If you haven't realized, stay safe. You know, just look after yourself. That's all we can do right now. And get vaccinated, please. So today we're going to be talking about, you know, opening up, George. You said, you know, Singapore is preparing to live with COVID-19 as an endemic disease, right? Just like the flu. The UK plans to scrap regulations of physical distancing and wearing masks. You know, come Monday, they're opening up everything. What does this mean to live with COVID-19? And when will it actually be appropriate for Malaysia to open up as well? Joining us from Yong Lu Lin School of Medicine, National University of Singapore, Professor Tiki Pangestu. He's a visiting professor there. Welcome to the show, Professor. How are you today?
I'm good. Pleasure to be joining you today.
You know, Professor, when we spoke to you in January, you said you didn't think that the pandemic would end like SARS did, right? But the virus would remain within us. But that it would lose its virulence, you mentioned. What does that actually mean when a disease is endemic?
When a disease is endemic, it means that the virus is there to stay with us. And basically, it means we need to learn to live with it. Okay. And it's not so much that it loses its virulence, but it means we are able to live with it because we can handle the consequences of being infected a lot better than, let's say, at the early stages of a pandemic. So, you know, Singapore, as you already mentioned, they've tried to define what a lot of people call it the new normal. I'm not really sure that it's a new normal, but basically that's what they're trying to do, you know, sort of say, okay, it's here to stay, so let us learn to live with it. And basically, the components of what that looks like is basically getting rid of the idea to achieve zero transmission. Okay, that's just no longer the aim or the goal. So living with it means, number one, increasing your vaccination coverage. Number two, continuing with testing, okay, but making it more rapid, more convenient, and more targeted, instead of trying to do mass testing of entire populations. You test sort of the high risk, the vulnerable groups, the healthcare workers, those on the front lines, vulnerable parts of the population. You make available antigen rapid tests, which are much faster, and you make it more convenient. In Singapore, you can even buy it, do it yourself, test in the pharmacy, okay? So vaccination, testing, of course, if there are cases, contact tracing will always have to be there. And I think the other important component of the Singapore approach is social responsibility. So yes, you try to vaccinate as much of the population as possible. At the same time, you continue the proven public health interventions. Wearing of masks, social distancing, hand hygiene, avoiding crowded places, et cetera, et cetera. And another interesting dimension is to avoid stigmatization of people who have probably, you know, contracted COVID in the past. So that's the Singapore approach towards sort of accepting it's endemic, that it's not going to go away. We're going to just have to live with it. And Mira, you mentioned we need to laugh a little bit. I heard a quote just a few days ago from the Indonesian Coordinating Minister for Political, Legal and Security Affairs, Mahfud MD. And he said this, coronavirus is like your wife. You think you can control it. You realize you can't. And then you just have to learn to live with it.
What so about then, the husbands? I mean, it's the same thing. The same thing applies to the husbands, Professor. I'm sure it does.
Exactly. I'm sure it does.
So it's very much like the Spanish flu, right? I mean, the Spanish flu pandemic, you know, it killed about 50 million people in 1918. It remained in the circulation for four decades, and it became less virulent for most of the time. And now the influenza A since then has been sort of descendants of the 1918 virus, would you say?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, influenza viruses, you know, a little bit like the coronavirus, they're mutating all the time. So, yeah, over time. And remember that the Spanish flu happened at a time when, you know, science was nowhere near as advanced as it is today in terms of understanding public health measures, in terms of development of vaccines, in terms of, devices like ventilators, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a tough comparison to make. But yes, you know, the virus has become part of our lives.
Prof, you obviously highlighted the roadmap that Singapore has in order to open up. Right. Can you give some examples of other countries, and then do they have the similar roadmaps?
Yeah, I think certainly the UK, once again, because of its real emphasis on attaining very high vaccination coverage, they have gone the way of Singapore in terms of reducing some of the restrictions. Where they differ, of course, and some parts of the US also, I think they differ. They are probably sort of in between what Singapore is doing and what other countries may not even be in a position to begin considering, because in the UK and parts of the US, they are not as maybe obsessive about ensuring that people continue wearing masks. I mean, that's just one example. Many other Western European countries are also relaxing their restrictions. Yeah.
Prof, another thing on a similar line, I mean, we all see that how China is living on its own parallel universe. And then, you know, we really can never find out how much of the population is truly vaccinated, and then also whether it was a force imposed on them. You know, is China kind of like controlling this? And then because from the look of it, China itself already had, opened up within its community. Is that true perception?
Well, of course, you know, this is, I guess, sometimes a perception problem with China. Can you really sort of, accept and believe the statistics that comes out of there? But I mean, I just have to take it at face value. And if you ask me what is the gold standard country that has been the leader in terms of managing, okay, I'm not saying controlling, managing the COVID pandemic, number one is China. By a long shot. I mean, a lot of people say Singapore, but to me, it's China, okay? And, you know, it's a combination of different factors, not just on the health dimension, but, you know, on the geopolitical side, on the digital technology, how they have used it to such effective impact in terms of contact tracing and very quickly clamping down in terms of how rapidly. I mean, they can test a city of 10 million in 1 week. I mean, that's just incredible. You know, so obviously, once again, just like Singapore, what China has been able to achieve may not be achievable in many, many countries, but certainly some lessons learned. And I think speed of reaction, good governance, good healthcare facilities, and over again, we have to talk about social capital, you know, the sense of social responsibility amongst the population, which is, for me, a lot of the COVID pandemic is all about human behavior, you know. And unless you have a population that's willing to not just look after themselves, but be responsible to sort of look at the health of the whole community, it's going to be a tough challenge.
Yeah, I mean, how realistic is this expectation of people's ability to self-regulate, right? I mean, it'll be interesting to watch the UK. I mean, there's nothing to compel you to wear a mask anymore. You don't have to social distance. You know, it's, I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to watch how the UK actually does.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, my daughter works as a physician in London. And I was actually struck by the numbers. Yes, okay. I think you're right that the Delta variant has increased the number of cases quite alarmingly. I think 50,000 over cases in the UK. But the important thing is 50,000 cases, but 49 deaths. You look at Indonesia, 40,000 cases, 990 deaths. Okay, so my own perspective of this is that we have become too obsessive with the number of daily cases. Okay, and Singapore is actually moving away from that. They're going to stop reporting the number of daily cases. What is important is the severe cases, the hospitalizations, and the deaths. Okay, as long as your healthcare system is able to cope with that, which Indonesia obviously is having problems with, and also Malaysia, from what I'm hearing. Okay, as long as you have that, then those daily huge number of cases shouldn't be your major concern. Yeah? Sorry, Josh, go ahead.
I guess this is in keeping with what Dale Fisher was telling us 2 weeks ago, that eventually the number doesn't matter. It could be tens of millions, but as long as not too many people are critically ill and crippling the health system, it's no longer an issue. Because I remember watching the Euro 2021 and looking at the Wembley Stadium packed with 50, 70,000 people, and your immediate reaction is that there's going to be a catastrophe in 2 weeks' time. But if out of all that, only a small number of people who really fall ill, it really doesn't matter anymore.
Exactly. I mean, do you hear the number of flu cases being reported daily? You don't.
Right?
You know, so the yearly number of flu deaths around the world is still it's a significant number of people dying. Okay? And, you know, for a number of reasons. So I think we need to get away from this. But once again, you know, it's easy to say when your health system is like Singapore or like UK, when you're well prepared. But Indonesia, Malaysia, I see quite disturbing scenes of hospitals being overwhelmed.
Yeah. And it goes back to the vaccination rates, right? Yeah, Singapore, exactly. More than 50% of the population vaccinated.
Right.
The UK, more than 60%. We're at 12.
Exactly.
We're getting there. We will get there. We'll come back and...
Well, Mira, I'm sorry, but 12 is still, you know, worryingly low for me, you know. I mean, given the... Especially in the context of the Delta variant, I mean, the most recent data I'm seeing is that, you know, something called the reproductive number, the R0, or the Delta, is now being estimated at between 5 to 8, which is significantly higher than the original coronavirus, which was around 2 to 3. Okay. And that's worrying. 5 to 8. I mean, George, you will know that measles, which is probably the most contagious, that has a RO of 18. So, you know, we're getting there. And it does explain, you know, this very rapid increase in cases in that you're seeing in Malaysia and in Indonesia.
Okay, we'll come back and continue the discussion. We're finding out whether we're ready to live with COVID-19. On the line with me, Professor Tiki Pangestu. He's a visiting professor at the Yong Lu Lin School of Medicine, National University of Singapore. And of course, Dr. George Lee in our Doctor in the House series. We'll come back and answer more of your questions. If you have them, give us a call. It's 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's Health and Living. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. Dr. George Lee, my co-host, consultant urologist on the line with us, as well as Professor Tiki Pangestu. He's a visiting professor at the Yong Loo Lin School of Medicine, National University of Singapore. We're discussing, are we ready to live with COVID-19? I think there's a lot of talk about the disease becoming endemic. We see countries starting to open up, easing the regulations and restrictions and lockdowns. Singapore being one, very cautiously moving towards that direction. The UK, on the other hand, I don't know. I mean, Monday, it feels like it's going to be free for all, do whatever you feel like kind of a thing, which is a little worrying. Malaysia, chugging along, trying to increase our vaccination rates with the Delta variant going a little out of control in our society. Just stay safe, everyone. As Professor said, our knot is between 5 and 8, which is a lot more infectious compared to the original COVID-19 virus. So stay safe. One of the things you spoke about when it comes to the virus becoming endemic. Professor, you spoke about increasing vaccinations, which is very much key. You've spoken about continue testing rapidly. If you start to ease and sort of get rid of some of these lockdowns, to have more rapid and convenient and targeted testing, as you've mentioned. Singapore already has test kits going around, which makes it a lot easier to test. Contact tracing, very, very important. Social responsibility, which is something we need to keep an eye on, because humans being humans, you know, sometimes having a great sense of social responsibility differs from one person to the other. And of course, we need to avoid stigmatization, which is also very much key to us actually managing this virus. Now, in some cases, Professor, there are some who say that lifting restrictions will allow new infections to add to herd immunity. From a public health perspective, what do you think? Is that a risky strategy?
Once again, at the end of the day, if you have achieved a significant level of vaccination, and always the goal is, this phenomenon called herd immunity. But with an R0 of 5 to 8, that target of herd immunity is going to be significantly higher. Okay, and I think if you look around the views of various experts, you're now sort of looking at, a figure of around 80 to 90% before you can achieve that target of herd immunity. And of course, the appearance of variants, as long as you have only a significantly lower percentage of your population having been vaccinated, the virus is going to continue circulating, okay? And if the virus continues to circulate, it's going to continue to mutate. So the appearance of variants is a given. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. Yeah, George?
Yeah, Prof, with that in mind, I mean, what is the threshold that is scientifically proven to be acceptable before a government make up their mind that they want to actually, open up of the vaccinated population? What is this sort of like a proportion of population that is vaccinated before you make up that make up your mind?
Well, I'm going to hesitate to give you an actual number. Obviously, it's a bit of a moving target, especially because of the appearance of these variants. And of course, if you have variants appearing with a higher transmissibility, I think your target sort of 80-90% is going to remain that high. But it's people tend to be more conservative on these, and it may well be that 60-70% may well be sufficient. Okay, but once again, if you are able to take care and manage the severe cases, the hospitalizations, and reduce the number of deaths, once again, I'm not so focused on achieving a certain percentage. I'm more focused on dealing with the severe cases and ramping up your vaccination coverage with whatever vaccine that you can lay your hands on. So I think there's a bit too much talk about target percentages And it's just not really realistic in my view.
You know, Professor,
it's changing all the time.
Yep. You mentioned about the R-naughts and the Delta variant, right? And you did say if a large number of the population continues to get infected with the Delta variant, there's a chance it can actually mutate. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, of course. I mean, it's that's just what viruses do.
Yep.
But,
so,
you know, most of the mutations are totally harmless, you know, no effect at whatsoever. Some mutation may actually cause increased transmissibility, like what's already happened with Delta. There was another one called Delta Plus, but there's not much data coming out of that one as yet. But yeah, it's just it's part of the biology of the virus. As long as it continues spreading in a population, it will mutate.
And so if the UK opens up, for an example, they have the Delta variant spreading very quickly there as well. So there is a chance that there could be a variant of concern, perhaps, if the Delta variant decides to mutate, this virus mutates into something else.
Yeah, that's true. But if you have 60-70% of your population vaccinated, okay, the magnitude and the likelihood of the variants mutating to even more dangerous variants is going to be significantly reduced.
Okay.
Because if your 60% of your population is vaccinated, there's going to be less transmission, okay? And there's going to be fewer people getting sick. And if you're not sick and actually shedding lots and lots of virus, okay, the amount of virus circulating in the community is also going to be reduced. And therefore, the mutation rate of the viruses will also be less. I mean, that's theoretically the possibility.
On that note about the vaccinations, before we move on to talk about rapid testing kits, can you tell me what is your predictions about boosters? Because obviously that is part of the equation as well. In order to maintain that lockdown, open up, it's not failed. Then, you know, obviously, the companies that produce the vaccine said it's about time to start thinking about booster, and WHO actually disagree. What's your view on the boosters?
My view on booster is at the moment there's absolutely no evidence to say that it's required. Okay, the first dose, the second dose provides ample protection, but once again, okay, it's still early days because I think we're still not even a full year after people have received both doses. I really think to talk about boosters is premature. If you want another view, I actually think that the idea of booster addresses a much bigger issue. Instead of giving people in rich countries boosters, give those doses to people in developing countries who haven't even had one dose. Okay, so to me, it's a bit of a moral dilemma as well to be pushing for boosters, you know. And of course, from the point of view of pharmaceutical companies, the more doses they sell, the more profit they make. But, you know, I think the equity issue here is an important one, because I don't see any real evidence that you need a booster at this point. You always say precautionary principle. I have three jabs. Maybe it's better. Ooh, maybe not. But I don't see any evidence of waning immunity after these two doses. What? It's early days.
Okay. So, Professor, you said just now there's no real, percentage for herd immunity or vaccination rate before you decided you want to manage it as an endemic disease. What would be some benchmarks then to look at before we decide? Is it purely hospitalization rates and death rates, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, hospitalization, severe cases, those that require oxygen support, those that require ventilator, and of course, the number of deaths. I mean, that's what the UK is monitoring very closely. But the bottom line is always the same. Just, you know, increase, ramp up your vaccination coverage, you know, as fast as you can with whatever vaccine you can get your hands on. But, you know, that's also easier said than done, because for many countries who are, including Malaysia, who are aiming to go beyond your 12%, there are many challenges ahead, including insufficient supply, including logistic issues of actually getting the vaccine delivered in a safe, efficient and effective manner. And last but not least, the issue of hesitancy, you know. People are still reluctant to get vaccinated. So what do? Do you offer incentives? For example, one of my friends suggested, you know, go and get a vaccine. If those people who don't want to take the vaccine, if you get the vaccine, we'll give you 10 kgs of durians, you know, something like that. Are incentives the way to go? Are you going to go regulation? Unless you go get a vaccine, you won't be admitted to restaurants. I mean, there are so many issues that I think each country will need to deal with within its own context.
Do you think
with that in mind? I mean, Vera, you know, we probably will invite the Klang Valley to talk about different incentives to get people
sure.
So for those of you who are interested, please call in. Right?
Yes, 7732900, WhatsApp 0187899899. Ask Professor anything you want about, you know, the COVID-19 becoming endemic and how we're going to start living with it. Singapore's already talking about it. The UK is doing it. Israel has done it, Professor, but they see numbers going up now.
Yeah, but once again, you know, with all these, as we all know, the vaccine, none of these vaccines are 100% effective. No vaccine can be 100% effective. And there will always be, George, you probably know well this, that genetically, there are always a certain percentage of the population who are non-responders for whatever reason. It could be genetic, it could be they have some other underlying conditions, it could be that the vaccine, when it was given to them, has not been stored properly. That's one of the problems in Indonesia, when they try to vaccinate in remote areas without the proper storage facilities. I've seen photos on social media where vaccines are being stored in buckets with ice because they don't have enough facility to store them properly. So many different potential factors that can result in upsurge of cases. Yeah. But as long as your deaths, as long as your hospitalizations remain low, that to me is the target, not the percentage of herd immunity.
Do you see isolating positive cases a need going forward?
I think if they're proven to be infectious and if they are potentially likely to go into a more severe form of disease. Yes, of course. But even Singapore is moving to actually remove isolation for contacts of cases who are not severely ill, because there's quite a clear correlation between severity of illness and the amount of virus that you're shedding.
Yeah. Prof, you mentioned that the first thing in Singapore's roadmap is obviously the vaccination. The second part is the mass testing, right? Can you tell us about the rationale behind the mass testing and also what sort of accuracy are we having with these fast self-DIY test kits?
Yeah, I think what I wanted to say was that they are actually moving away from mass indiscriminate testing of entire populations. Okay, they are moving towards more targeted testing of highly vulnerable groups, the elderly, perhaps those people working in frontline areas, like people working at airports and ports, healthcare workers, obviously, regular testing, and they have extended testing, almost, I think, requiring daily testing for people working in the F&B, for example, people who are in daily contact with the population at large. So it's sort of a targeted testing, and they are using antigen rapid tests, which, as we know, is probably not quite as sensitive or as accurate as the PCR test. They are experimenting with do-it-yourself kits, but once again, you know, there's probably insufficient data at the moment to really get an idea of accuracy and specificity and sensitivity. They are doing a lot of R&D even on tests which uses just like you breathe into a tube rather than taking a swab, you know. So basically, I think the PCR test is still going to be the gold standard, but perhaps applied more to sort of as a confirmatory test, should you, get a positive antigen rapid test, then you will probably proceed to a PCR test. So it's sort of more targeted, more rapid, more convenient testing. You know, whereas you know, each country does its own thing. Whereas China, I think, is basically still continuing its policy of just, you know, testing everybody.
Yeah, China is still planning to keep their borders shut for another year. Or so that what does that actually mean?
You're talking about China?
Yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's what they call the precautionary principle. I think basically they've essentially controlled and managed the epidemic very well. And but you have seen that in several instances, in some provinces, especially those that border other countries, they have seen isolated outbreaks, which they've actually controlled very quickly and very rapidly. I don't know. I'm not an expert in sort of more economic and social issues, but I think the country is sort of big enough, and I think their economy is moving along quite well. They have a huge domestic market, probably a huge domestic tourism market as well. So perhaps in some ways they don't really see the need to open up, you know, to the bigger world, and they would rather just play it safe for the moment and be self-sufficient. I mean, that's just my own non-scientific view on that.
Sure. We'll come back and find out a little bit more. I think I want to know about Singapore. I mean, Singapore needs to open up their borders. They're very much dependent on the world.
Yes,
yeah, yes. And how that would be managed, because that would mean people coming in and out from all over the world. And that will be, give us a sneak peek into what it would be like to open up borders and start traveling again. I think George would be quite happy about that. At least it's something to look forward to, George. I mean, 18 months of you not moving anywhere is really, I'm surprised you're doing quite well, George. For someone,
and we're getting withdrawal all the time.
For someone whom I consider has ants in his pants, can't stay in one place. But we'll come back and continue the discussion. If you have a question, give us a call, 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. It's our Health and Living segment. Dr. George Lee, my co-host, consultant neurologist, on the line with me. Joining us also from the Yong Loo Lin School of Medicine, National University of Singapore, Professor Tiki Pangestu. He's a visiting professor over there. We're discussing, are we ready to live with COVID-19? Sort of Singapore and the UK taking the lead. We're going to see how they're going to be opening up the whole idea of living with the virus that is endemic, right? Professor Singapore is very much dependent on the rest of the world, and you know they'll have to open up. We can understand why, and they depend a lot on people coming in and out of the country. How do you think that will be managed?
Yes, I think that's a very good point, which probably differentiates Singapore from China as an example. The Singapore economy is so dependent on foreign workers. Okay, all the construction that's going on here is dependent on migrant workers from India, from China, from Bangladesh, etc. Domestic workers, Philippines, Indonesia, Myanmar. It really has to consider the economic factors and balance it with the threat of outbreaks happening in the future. How they're going to manage it, but once again, it's not in any way, obviously they can manage it to a point by requiring whatever foreigners, be it migrant workers or tourists, that come in to have the required pre-departure testing, etc. They may continue the quarantine requirements just to make sure that these people don't become sick after they arrive in Singapore. I think in terms of opening up more broadly, the way they are talking about it is, I don't like the term, they are talking about travel bubbles. That's been talked about with Australia, for example, but that's been put on hold after what happened in Sydney this past couple of days. They've been talking about it with Hong Kong, but that's also been put on hold. But I think in the future, that's the way they're going to go. You know, maybe New Zealand. Well, let's see. Situation changes all the time.
Prof, if you were to advise the Singapore government about, letting in foreign travelers, Do you think it makes sense just to let people who had all the double, both doses of vaccinations to freely travel as a kind of like a vaccination passport? Do you think that is a sensible way forward?
I think so. But I think the Singapore government is going to be still fairly cautious about this. And you probably heard the statement from WHO today, in fact, that they still do not support the idea of a vaccination passport to allow complete unrestricted travel for travelers, especially for leisure purposes. And I think there are many, many reasons for that. Obviously, if you have received both doses, you are less likely, yeah? But there are also other issues around equity, for example.
For example, I understand countries like Italy and Greece has opened up their borders to tourists who have been vaccinated with both doses on right. specific type of vaccines. Is there any lessons we can learn from their practice?
Yeah, I think Italy and most countries in Western Europe will follow the guidelines from the EU, the European Union, and they've basically endorsed the concept of vaccination passport, okay, to allow travel within their borders if you have received both doses of the vaccine. But I can see some countries actually backtracking a little bit on that, like Spain, for example. They've just reintroduced some restrictions, and that makes it for a very confusing situation. You know, what happens to all the British tourists that have gone over to Spain when those restrictions were lifted, okay? That's going to affect their travel plans. Is that going to affect what is going to happen when they return to the UK? So, you know, the idea of a vaccine passport is at the moment because of, let's say, non-uniform acceptance between different countries and different parts of the world, that's going to be a long way. I think for Singapore, it's going to be some time before they say, if you've received both doses, you can come into Singapore and move freely. I think that's not going to happen yet.
I mean, we're talking about travel, but, you know, there are also equity considerations, Professor.
Yeah, exactly.
Poor people, who are affected by COVID are treated. And if we are going to treat this as endemic, they're going to be disadvantaged. You just
exactly.
want to elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, I mean, if there's one single lesson that the pandemic has highlighted to me, it's the inequities that, you know, exist around the world. Obviously, inequity to access to vaccines is the most glaring one. But there are, you know, other inequities in terms of disadvantaged minority populations. Migrant workers in Singapore, they were hugely affected by the pandemic. What about, you know, people in prisons? What about people with disabilities? Let's not forget those who are suffering from sort of mental health impacts. By and large, I think the data out of the UK basically tells you that minorities and ethnic minorities, for example, and in the US, minorities are disproportionately affected in terms of number of cases as well as severe cases. So, you know, that is a big concern.
Okay. Moving away from all these vaccines and also the test kit and that sort of thing, Prof, you mentioned something that is really crucially important. It's about the stigma of the disease. Can you tell us a little bit about the experience in Singapore and how is that going to be overcome when the lockdown or all these, when they open up, Singapore is going to be like?
Yeah, I mean, you probably heard the story when there was a cluster in either Tan Tock Seng or Changi Hospital, okay? Some of the health workers that were part of the cluster, they had to sort of, find alternative accommodation. They didn't want to go back to their homes in Singapore, and they had to find alternative accommodation to rent a room outside. And they were denied because the landlord said, oh, you've been exposed to COVID, I'm not going to rent out my room to you. Okay, so that was what triggered this issue of stigma in Singapore, that people, healthcare workers, you know, who were looking after these patients were being discriminated against.
Okay, shocking, so, right?
Yeah, sorry?
Shocking, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely shocking. And, you know, at the end of the day, yeah, you can do it any other way in terms of approach, but it's all about, once again, you know, communication and education really social responsibility. I mean, these are people who are putting their lives on the line, you know, and you deny them a room, you know. So I can see this happening, like what happened with HIV/AIDS, you know, stigma associated with having the infection. And despite the fact that you can tell people, oh, you know, you've recovered from COVID, there's always that perception, oh, are you going to give it to me? Are you going to contaminate my family members, you know? So, you know, this is once again an issue of, education, communication to ensure people that it's not a risk. It's, you know, the fear factor is there, you know? So,
yeah. Prof, when do you think, and this is a very difficult question, I know, but I'm just going to ask you anyway, when do you think the world will be able to live with this virus being endemic?
I don't think that's a very difficult question. I think the question is not so much if, but when, okay? It will happen, I feel, when there's more equity. And when I say more equity, in terms of different countries in different parts of the world not being this far apart, okay, but being a bit closer, okay? I worry, for example, about Africa, okay? That's like a bit of a time bomb, you know, in terms of it hasn't happened yet. It has maybe less than 1% of the vaccines dose available. So unless that equity gap is narrowed, I think in terms of the whole world, learning to live with it, that's going to take some time. And it's so dependent on perhaps the most urgent priority, which is making the vaccine available to everybody. I mean, it's a cliche. No one is safe until everyone is safe. And, you know, each country is going to be very cautious about opening up, even Singapore. Yeah.
Prof, you in January, you predicted that COVID is not going to go away and in some way we're going to live with this. How do you predict where we will be this time next year?
This time next year, I'm going to predict that there will be at least 10 more variants, okay? But I'm also going to predict that these variants are going to be well managed. I'm going to predict that the vaccines are going to keep up with the variants, okay? The technology is such that even if there was a variant that's more dangerous, causing more severe disease, there will be iterations of the vaccines like there is with the flu vaccine. The flu vaccine changes every year. So, you know, I'm a great believer and I believe the science has just been absolutely incredible. Okay.
Do you predict we were able to come and visit you in Singapore?
From Malaysia?
Yes, this time next year.
This time next year.
Hesitant.
Difficult. I would have to be positive. You know, my wife always tells me that I look at the glass as always as half full. Okay. So this time next year, yeah, I would say so. I hope so.
Do you think that you dare enough to come to Malaysia this time next year?
I'm dying to go to Malaysia. I've not been able to visit my mom-in-law. And my wife hasn't been able to see her for, you know, nearly 2 years now. So I'm dying to go.
Can I ask why are you hesitant?
Hesitant to what?
That, you know, by this time next year, whether we will be able to come to Singapore.
I think I'm hesitant more in terms of the fact that you might still have to do a quarantine, okay? And I'm not sure whether how many people are willing to do that, because I had to do it in January when I returned to Singapore from Switzerland, okay? And I had to do 2 weeks locked up in a hotel room, and it's not something you want to do, you know, too often. So until such time as... I think the Singapore government have intimated that for fully vaccinated people, there is a possibility that they will reduce the quarantine period, okay? But they haven't given an exact timeline. Even if it's reduced to a week, that's still a lot better than 2 weeks, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah. Definitely.
Too many unknowns. I better not to make too many predictions. We will call you
and just hold you to it. And then, do you think this virus will moderate on its own, like SARS did?
My answer to that is that it's not, you know, you shouldn't ask, is the virus going to moderate? I think the answer is, will we be able to deal with the virus in a way that makes the virus impact more moderate? Right. I think that's the way to look at it. And with vaccination, with improved healthcare facility, with good informatics, with testing, with speed of reaction, that can happen. Regardless of what the virus does, the virus is just going to continue doing its own thing. There's no way of escaping that. There's no way of stopping that. And forget about this talk about elimination. It's not going to happen.
And given where Malaysia is, would you have a message for us?
Vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. What else can I say? Yeah. And the other thing is with regards to your severe cases, you know, have you really... I don't know. I'm just talking off the top of my head. Have you really pulled out all the stops here? Have you really mobilized all the private hospitals, for example, to join in the fight? Have you mobilized the armed forces? Because this is what Indonesia is doing. The armed forces, medical corps have been really pushed into this fight. You know, all hands on deck with this kind of situation. And don't forget the social responsibility dimension, which in many ways is the most challenging. You know,
George.
Well, Prof, thank you for letting us have a glimpse of what potential roadmaps we have. I totally, totally agree with what you said. Health equity is paramount and no one is safe until everyone is safe.
Right.
Thank you both very much for joining us today. My co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, and Professor Tiki Pangestu, visiting professor at the Yong Lu Lin School of Medicine from the National University of Singapore, discussing Are We Ready to Live with COVID-19 on Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.